QJFM 95.4.
Dynamically shaping the future.
New surface.
12 to 3 p.m.
On UJFM Insights.
So it's not just any special guests. They have from the Neurodiversity Center. We started this journey with this beautiful center a long time ago.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
For as long as I've been here.
No, literally. Mm-hmm. We've been learning. And I promise you. And today we're going to learn some more. With us, we do have Miss Athena Clayton. How are we doing today?
I'm so well. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here with you two ladies today. Mm-hmm. I've really been looking forward to this opportunity to engage with you, to talk about these really exciting topics.
No, most definitely.
Yes.
For those that don't know you, please, if you don't mind, just introduce yourself and the title or the role that you play in this thing, this particular thing that we're going to be talking about today.
Okay, thank you so much. So my name is Athena Clayton. I am a lecturer and an educational psychologist. I've been working with the Department of Educational Psychology here at UJ since April last year. I've been really very blessed to join our department. And one of the things I have been a part of is the opening of our Neurodiversity Center on Soweto campus. And it's a beautiful center. We have some really exciting things in store for the university and the surrounding community. So we're really excited for that. And one of the things that we are very keen to do, of course, is to promote awareness of some of the neurodiversity conditions and disorders. You know, we really do feel that knowledge is power, really.
And definitely.
So thank you so much for this opportunity.
Yeah, no, most definitely. Now, today we're going to be speaking all things motor disorders and traumatic brain injuries, also known as TBI. I know motor from life science. I think it's nerves or something. So there's motor and then there's the other one. I think it starts with... Yeah, I'm not expecting
one way out. I'm thinking of a car.
No, literally. And I'm not sure if you're able to see this, you're able to see the confusion that we have. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of something from life science. I'm assuming it's a nerve and she's assuming it's a car. Mm-hmm. We need you to just give clarity because you're the expert here. Now, maybe let's start here. What are motor disorders and what are some of the symptoms?
Oh, thank you for that question. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, it has nothing to do with automobiles.
Yeah. Thank God.
We would be in trouble. So it's really about our bodies and the way that we move, right? Okay. So motor disorders are really disorders of our nervous system where we have non-typical movements.
Okay.
Sometimes it's a lack of intended movements. So for example, you know, it could be something like pouring water from a bottle into a glass, for example, that you want to sort of pour very carefully. You don't want to spill. It could be tying your shoelaces, thinking about the sequence of tying your shoelaces, fastening buttons. It could be something like coordinating movements so you can ride a bicycle. Okay, so there are a lot of movements that we do every single day that actually require quite a lot of planning that we're not necessarily aware of because we sort of have an idea of what we want to do and we're able to send the thought process into our various muscle groups and we're able to perform the tasks. But sometimes the children struggle with this. There's a lack of the intended movements. They also have where there's an excess of unintended movements. So that could be where somebody might have like a tic where they might sort of like tilt their head off and to the side and sort of in a jerking kind of manner. That's something that they're not planning to do. It's something that just kind of spontaneously happens and they don't have control over it. So that very broadly is motor disorders. We have different types of motor disorders. So I'm going to be talking to you about the one which is called a developmental coordination disorder, and we sometimes talk about it as dyspraxia. It's quite an interesting one because it's been around for so long and people haven't really known how to make sense of it and they haven't known how to describe it. In fact, at one point it was even called clumsy child syndrome.
Wow.
So, you know, we've known about it for a while, but we haven't quite known how to make sense of it. We haven't known how to categorize it. It was actually categorized as a specific learning disorder. I know one of my colleagues spoke to you a little while about them. I think, you know, that's where you got the dyslexia, where there's difficulty with reading, or dyscalculia.
Yeah, the specific learning disorders. Yes.
So this was actually once categorized under that category because of the difficulty with the planned movement. It would obviously spill over to tasks such as reading, copying, writing and copying and things like that. So it was categorized there, but now it's categorized under motor disorders. And there's quite a few different features, and they vary according to age, but you can actually see it right from when an individual's still very young, when they have delays in meeting their motor milestones, like rolling over or crawling or walking. And then when they start playing with toys and they have to do things like stack cups on top of one another, they may have a delay in those sorts of or difficulty coordinating movements to tackle those kinds of tasks. And then when they get older, they struggle to play sports a little bit. They struggle with playground apparatus, such as the monkey bars, those sorts of things. Sports, as I said, they might struggle with even things like getting dressed in the morning. Doing their buttons and their zippers, you know, and their shoelaces. So those are some of the things that you would see. The challenge is that because human development is actually quite diverse. Just because a child has a delay in rolling over, for example, it doesn't mean that they automatically have a motor disorder. Yeah. So often children are only diagnosed with a motor disorder when they're already quite old, but specifically this disorder that I'm speaking about. So that does make it a little bit challenging. Because it is a neurodevelopmental disorder, though, what we'll find is that it's not something like a child is just struggling with coordination for the first 2 years of life and then they outgrow it. It's something that remains with the child throughout their childhood. And one of the things that you'll see is that all of their coordinated motor skills are substantially below the level expected for their age. And not only that, it impacts significantly on their ability to manage daily activities.
I see.
Yeah.
But what causes these motor disorders?
It's also something that I think we're trying to learn a lot more about. Mm-hmm. There does seem to be something to do with low birth weight, being born prematurely. Mm-hmm. There is quite a strong link with that. There is a little bit of research that talks about prenatal exposure to alcohol as well. Mm-hmm. There does seem to be some genetic cause as well that we do see. So we are still trying to understand it a little bit more fully, but there does seem to be that those sorts of links.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also do know that when, and this is common for all neurodevelopmental disorders, we do seem to see that when one individual has a disorder such as ADHD, for example, they may very well also present with a motor disorder as well.
Makes sense.
Okay. So what are some of the classroom strategies that can assist a child with motor disorders?
It really depends a lot on the child's needs, I think. But there are a couple of strategies that we can use. So as I said, one of the things that we do see with children with motor, well, specifically with this particular developmental coordination disorder, they may struggle with writing, with copying. So there what you would do is you would figure out strategies that could help them manage writing tasks within the classroom. So you would maybe encourage them to use apps such as speech-to-text apps and things like that, those kinds of software, dictaphones and so on, because they've got the knowledge. It's just about a difficulty maybe in being able to plan their work or being able to put it down on paper. Instead of requiring them to copy a lot of content from the board, particularly for subjects like mathematics, where you really need to copy with tremendous accuracy. And if you think about the columns that the numbers have to be written down in, it may be useful to provide worksheets or specific handouts with like blocks where they can write information in. Providing additional time for work is quite important. Often the planning also, that they may require some planning, some assistance with their planning. So giving sort of more specific step-by-step instructions to help them learn how to sort of navigate the task a little bit. And then another strategy that could work really well would be teaching them to kind of monitor themselves and their own needs. So, like, for example, if they are experiencing challenges with, like, their posture, for example, or those sorts of things, you could maybe encourage them to sort of know, to identify what their needs are and be able to know what the next step is. What do they need to do? Maybe they need to get up and stretch or have a break, those sorts of things. Another thing is to maybe identify that there may be a need for slightly different or adapted rules for some children. So, for example, if a child is struggling to tie their shoelaces, it's not because they're being silly or careless or unmotivated. They want to learn, but the sequence of tying the shoelace is a little bit challenging.
I see.
So then instead of insisting that they wear lace-up shoes, for example, you could perhaps make an accommodation for them where they could wear slip-ons, those sorts of things. The thing with this disorder is that different children will experience it at slightly various levels. So there may be some children who would even maybe struggle to navigate stairs, you know, depending on what on how extensive the disorder is.
Sure.
So it is quite important that I think there is that sort of tailored approach.
Mm-hmm.
But these are just some general kinds of strategies that may be useful.
Definitely.
Teachers.
Absolutely love it. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, out of everything, I mean, I'm learning, definitely, but I think what I'm highlighting right now, especially the last statement that Miss Athena just gave right now, is tailored. Mm. It's not the same. It's very vast. It's huge, right? Mm. So, you know, it depends on stages or with stages as well. We're learning. We're literally learning.
We are, hey?
Literally. And if you just joined in right now, we're speaking all things motor disorders and traumatic brain injuries. We do have Neurodiversity Center in studio. Absolutely loving all the conversations. We can speak on it on our social media platforms. It's at UJFM. All right, now 36 minutes after the hour, 2 o'clock, we are with the Neurodiversity Center. And if you do not know what this is about, then please just fasten up your seatbelts, because here, we're here to learn. Take out your dictionaries, take out your diaries, anything, and you are about to learn. I promise you that. We are joined by Miss Athena Clayson. We're speaking all things motor disorder and traumatic brain injuries, TBI, also known as that. And right about now, I need us to kindly just move to the specifics. What are traumatic brain injuries? Because you mentioned that we're speaking of these, but we don't really or quite know what that is. What is that?
So a traumatic brain injury is when an individual has sustained some form of an injury to their head, essentially. There's some form of a blow to the head, maybe like in sports, for example. Maybe when somebody falls and they knock their head on against the wall or a piece of furniture or the floor. Or if you think about like being in a car crash where the head sort of jolts forward and back.
Yeah.
And what happens is that the skull, which is really, really hard, sort of like the brain almost ricochets within the skull. And it could result in some form of a brain injury. So traumatic brain injury really does talk to the injury that is sustained after some form of a fall.
A force
that is impacted upon the brain.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So is there anything outside of maybe coercion or force that has been applied that can cause or lead to this? Because I'm sure a lot of people be asking themselves, if I'm not involved in a car accident or banged my head on a hard surface by mistake or something bad happens during sports, is there anything outside of that that I should avoid that could cause TBI?
So the most common ones would be that sort of blunt force trauma.
I see.
You know, it also could be so you do get different types of traumatic brain injuries.
Mm-hmm.
The way that we most commonly sort of classify them is not so much by the way that you sustain it. In fact, it's actually by the effect that it has had.
Okay.
So whether it's been a mild traumatic brain injury, moderate, severe, and so there's different categories. And that really depends on the types of symptoms that you see thereafter.
Makes sense.
So who can diagnose a TBI?
So it's usually done by a doctor, by mm-hmm. a physician, and what they would typically do is run a whole lot of diagnostic tests. They would do MRIs, CAT scans, those sorts of things to ascertain whether there has been noticeable damage to the actual brain itself. And often it will be detected that way. And then what you would also do is you would then maybe go to other professionals to determine what the impact has been of this TBI on you and the way that you function.
How does traumatic brain present?
Again, it presents quite differently depending on the severity with which you have sustained the TBI.
Yeah.
And also at the age at which you sustain it. So if you are a little bit younger, chances are, especially if it's more of a mild TBI, there's a greater chance that you'd be able to make some form of a recovery.
Sure.
But then obviously if you are a little bit older and it's a very severe traumatic brain injury that you've sustained, it's a little bit less likely that you would be able to make a recovery.
Yeah.
So for example, if it's a mild traumatic brain injury, and you're working with a child, you might see that their memory has been affected a little bit, their attention. They may process information a little bit more slowly. They may struggle with tasks like getting started on tasks, being able to monitor their own progress on tasks, losing track of time, those sorts of things. But it wouldn't, you might be able to see progress out of that. You may be able to see, you may be able to introduce interventions and so on that would assist the child. And then as the severity is a little bit more pronounced, then you also, and it also depends, sorry, what I didn't say earlier is it also depends the part of the brain that has been injured.
Oh, yes.
So especially if it's the frontal part of the brain, then you might see, particularly if it's more pronounced, more difficulties with social interactions, with emotional regulation and so on. So often it's not just the cognitive aspects that are affected, but our ability to socialize, our ability to control our emotions. So I was once working with an adult who sustained, I think she had a moderate traumatic brain injury, and she had been a very successful lawyer before she was involved in a car accident. And she really struggled across the board with almost all aspects. So she was still able to practice as a lawyer, but she needed a lot of guidance within the workplace. She really did struggle to kind of keep track of appointments, things like that. She experienced a lot of difficulties within her relationships, romantic relationships, peer relationships, even her family relationships, because she was quite volatile in her emotions. And that makes it very difficult for people if you are, as an individual, quite unpredictable. So sometimes it's not just the symptoms, but the impact, the effect that those symptoms have on those around you. So it can be quite quite pervasive, the effects of traumatic brain injury. In her case, one of the things that we were able to do, and this is what's so nice when you do get a chance to work with people, it also helps, you're able to figure out what sort of assistance do they need. So you're able to identify the correct interventions and also provide strategies for them. But it is quite challenging given how wide-ranging the symptoms could be. So when I say memory, it's not just your, it's partly your short-term memory, for example. So you might say something to me and then within a couple of minutes I've forgotten it, or I'm not paying attention long enough to even try and hold that information in my short-term memory. But often with learning information off by heart, people with with traumatic brain injury may experience long-term memory difficulties, both in terms of storing the information and retrieving the information. So it has impact for studying at school and at university and beyond. Attention is often compromised. Language sometimes as well. Sometimes there's difficulty retrieving words from your internal dictionary. You know what you want to say, but you just cannot find the word. It's at the top of your tongue, but you cannot access it.
Yeah.
So, like I said, it's quite wide-ranging. And unfortunately, I mean, I suppose this is true for many disorders, but this is a disorder that really does affect families and classrooms.
Unfortunately,
teachers.
Yeah. And I really, I'm learning a lot, obviously.
Yeah.
That's why I'm even struggling to speak right now. But you mentioned that, I mean, you gave tips to some teachers that this is how you can, you know, help out if you have a learner or student that's struggling from TBI or anything related to the brain. And this is how a mother can help out. For example, if the child is struggling with tying the shoelaces and all of that. And so I can imagine through practice and through being allowed as someone that has TBI, through being allowed to learn of things that you can do on a day-to-day basis, you're able to become maybe better. But can an individual fully recover from traumatic brain injury?
I think it's quite a controversial question.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a lot of evidence that, you know, brains are plastic. They, even in adulthood, there is a lot of plasticity. I think that there is often a better prognosis if the TBI is sustained when somebody is a little bit younger and the extent is more of mild severity.
Yeah.
And I suppose it also, but there are lots of risk factors, and that's something that I didn't mention earlier. So when we think about risk factors, if there's a history of learning difficulties, for example, before the child sustained or the adult sustained a traumatic brain injury, then the prognosis in terms of learning might be a little bit worse than if there wasn't such a history. If the parental and family support isn't very evident and isn't present, then there also may be less of a positive prognosis. If there are other comorbid medical conditions, if there's somebody who had pre-existing psychiatric conditions, perhaps, if there was previous traumatic brain injury for whatever reason. So we spoke a little bit earlier about with motor disorders, we spoke about being born prematurely, low birth weight. There are other sort of conditions that maybe would make a young child predisposed to having a worse prognosis if there is a traumatic brain injury sustained. So for example, if the mom you know, consumed alcohol while pregnant, that sort of thing may lead to a worse prognosis.
Mm.
So there are different factors that maybe would could promote a better prognosis or might prove to be a risk factor
for
prognosis that is positive.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
So what are some of the classroom strategies that can assist a child with a TBI?
I think it's just really important, firstly, for educators and schools to be educated on what is the TBI.
Definitely.
I think it's quite important, I didn't specify this for the motor disorder, and perhaps I should have. I think there's a lot of opportunity sometimes to label a child or an adolescent or even an adult by their condition.
Mm.
You know, I think
that's so true.
And I think it's quite important, as I said, for motor disorders, but especially for TBIs, the nature, the symptoms, the severity ranges so much that the danger of labeling because by a particular condition means that you really are limiting somebody by that label. And so I think it's quite important that firstly the family advocates for their child and says this is what the child's abilities are, this is what the support they need. So I think it's important that first of all families are encouraged to advocate for their child.
Yeah.
So I think that is quite important. I think that actually starts with even before they even come to school, having a good relationship with the doctors, understanding exactly what the condition is, what are the effects of the traumatic brain injury, how is it going to affect the child. So, for example, if you struggle with memory, it's not just to say my child struggles with memory, but to explain to teachers this is what it might mean.
Yeah.
They may require more exposure to the facts before they can memorize it.
Very
because
true.
They're going to struggle with attention. They're going to struggle to hold this information in mind.
Mm.
So they will need a lot of repetition.
Mm.
So please don't get frustrated if they don't if they don't understand something or remember it the first or second or third or fifth time.
Mm.
They possibly will need a lot more repetition. So I think that's the first thing, being able to say to the educator, this is what these are the symptoms that we've identified in the child, and this is what it means in terms of how they present in the classroom. I think it's also very tempting to talk about the academic side of things. So like I've spoken a lot about attention, memory and so on, but another thing that's really important is the socializing.
Exactly.
And this emotional regulation.
Yeah.
If we struggle to pay attention, we are going to be a lot more fidgety in class.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to concentrate as well. There is that impulsivity where people just cannot control their behavior.
Mm.
So they do say things that are maybe inappropriate. They may do things that are inappropriate. These are not naughty or bad individuals by any means.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who really often cannot control their behavior.
Yeah.
And it's something that they probably very much wish that they could control.
Mm.
So I think it is also about understanding that there will be the social and emotional aspects that also need to be managed. There may be a need for like social groups, social skills, training, which is quite important.
Mm-hmm.
We may need to help the teachers learn different skills to help children kind of manage. So helping them if we know that they have difficulty with time management, giving them specific cues like, you know, you've got 5 minutes, you've got 2 minutes.
Sure.
Helping them maybe adapting the work a little bit for them so that it's a little bit less, not less demanding, but a little bit more at the level that they can comfortably manage.
Mm.
Remember, a lot of these children, they're coming back to school. There may be a lot of, there will be probably a lot of emotions. Children are going to have a lot of questions.
Yes.
I think peers are very curious. I think also kind of managing that process. And just kind of being very aware of what can this child do or not do. So are they allowed to, for example, play sports? If they're allowed to play sports, which sports are they allowed
exactly.
to play? They may not be allowed to play contact sports, but they could do swimming, for example. Are they allowed to play on jungle gym equipment? You know, those sorts of things. So I think a lot of the strategies are very practical. You know, it's about helping the child in their day-to-day kind of life within the classroom, the school system, you know, beyond the classroom, and helping them, you know, manage their relationships with the teachers and their peers and the wider school community. And always remembering that what we're trying to do within the school is help that little person develop a sense of self and competency that they can take with them outside of school.
Exactly.
As they're building their identity, as they're building their lives.
Yeah.
So being very mindful to avoid the labels, to see the child's potential, the strengths, and to see where there's a lack of a particular skill as an opportunity to provide that skill training.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. It makes great sense. It
makes perfect sense.
It makes perfect sense. And honestly, with everything that you just said right now in response to the last question, I'm getting that everything that you just said stems from knowing the diagnosis and categorizing everything, literally breaking it down to, number one, understand as a parent, familiarize yourself with the strengths, the weaknesses, and how you can combat all of them. And, you know, and then that way you're able to share with the teachers, with the community, and educate. So it's definitely all of our responsibility. And if you feel like the parent of a child that suffers from TBI is not doing enough, then do it. If you know that this is what, if they were able to share with you, because I can imagine, I mean, we spoke to even parents that came through for interviews under the Neurodiversity Center, and they do really much mention that they were also traumatized. They were scared when they learned of the diagnosis before. So you can imagine they can't do it alone. And so if they're going to share with the neighbor that this is the news that I got today from the doctor, from a specialist, take it upon yourself to make the research as well. Come on. It takes a village.
It does.
It takes a village. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming through, Miss Athena Clayton. Thank you so much for coming through and educating us and answering all of our questions.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. I've really loved meeting both of you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
We'll wrap it up just
UJFM
like that.
UJFM 95.4.
Dynamically shaping the future.